sociology at the University of Warwick. He's probably most closely associated with social epistemology, the study of social dimensions of knowledge or information. Originally from New York, Steve has been a permanent UK resident since 1998. His 2008 book, Descent Over Dissent, Intelligent Design's Challenge to Darwinism, has been the Times Higher Education Supplement's Book of the Week. So please, join with me in welcoming Professor Steve Fuller.
Let me just, before I have to blast off here. All right. So this is being recorded everywhere. As you can see, my technology is fairly limited. I'm just going to be writing some words periodically when I talk about things that you might not have heard of before. And so what I want to do here is basically talk about the relationship between Darwin and science, and the history of science, and his significance, and in a way, the strange kind of relationship that Darwinism has to science. Because, I mean, as you probably well know, I mean, there's some books out there, not just my book, but of course there's Daniel Dennett's book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, and Daniel Dennett, his most recent book is called Breaking the Spell, which is a kind of Darwinian explanation of religion. And there's a lot of that around, right? A lot of attempts to provide Darwinian evolutionary explanations of religion. It's interesting that there aren't a lot of Darwinian explanations of science. Okay, science is something that, as it were, one just sort of takes for granted, is something that provides some kind of evolutionarily adaptive advantage. But that's not at all obvious, and it wasn't even at all obvious to Charles Darwin. Okay. And in a sense, this is kind of the issue that I want to be talking about today. And before I actually get to the issue proper, I want to say a little bit about my background, because my background may be a little unusual, perhaps from the standpoint of the kind of people you're used to listening to, who are talking about the significance of Darwin in this anniversary year. First of all, my background is in history, philosophy, and sociology of science, and I'm professor of sociology at the University of Warwick currently. I've been involved in this area for at least 5 years, maybe even longer, depending on how you measure these things. But I was involved, for example, as an expert witness in the trial concerning the teaching of intelligent design in Pennsylvania 4 years ago. Okay. And since that time, I've written a couple of books that are related to the evolution-creation controversy. There's one of them out there, which was mentioned in the introduction. And there's a previous book called Science Versus Religion, which is a bit more introductory, you might say, that's published with Polity Press. And in addition, I've been involved in actually addressing many different sorts of groups with regard to the significance of this controversy, both religious and non-religious groups, and when we talk about religious groups, both Christian and non-Christian as well, and not only here, but in the United States as well. So now at this point, somewhat unintentionally, because I didn't plan this to happen, I've become sort of a person with a lot of experience in this area and have actually researched this area quite a lot. And the reason why I got brought into it in the first place was because there is this question about what exactly is science, and the sense in which, you know, Darwinism or evolution is science, and creationism and intelligent design, are they science? What do we mean by science? And I think the first thing that's interesting to point out is that the term scientist gets coined in the 1830s. Okay, and it gets coined by one of the founders of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, William Whewell. This is pronounced Whewell, and he was the master of Trinity College, Cambridge. He was a natural theologian, but also a geologist, and he is one of the people who we normally think of in my field as one of the founders of the field of the history and philosophy of science. Because basically, Whewell kind of laid out some conditions based on what he understood to be the way in which Isaac Newton managed to make the great breakthrough, as it were, culminating in the scientific revolution at the end of the 17th century, that sort of defined what science is. And Whewell's largely responsible in the modern period for really kind of making Newton, as it were, the point man for science. If you want to know what the paradigm case of a scientist is, Isaac Newton, right? Whewell is the person who pretty much gives the first very substantial justification for that claim. Of course, everybody thought Newton was a genius before then, but the whole idea of Newton being the exemplar of a certain kind of profession called the scientist, okay, Whewell's responsible for that. And part of the angle that Whewell had on this was that he was very worried in the 1830s that, you know, there's all this experimental science especially going on, chemistry and so forth, and it's happening outside the universities, where the universities basically mean Oxford and Cambridge, which are pretty much stuck teaching, you know, theology and the liberal arts, you know, and all the stuff that doesn't involve your hands. Right, but of course the thing about experimental science is it does involve your hands, and there's this kind of class snobbery that should not be underestimated that's going on at this time. So Whewell basically says, well, this is not going to work if the universities want to continue to stay in business. They have to be able to incorporate these new forms of knowledge that are being produced outside of the universities. Okay, and how do we do this? Well, we have to say that somehow the pursuit of science has to be professionalized. It isn't just something that is sufficient to be a mechanic who has curiosity and so forth, but you need to undergo a certain kind of training. And you see, Newton is a good example of this, because Newton's a professor of mathematics at Cambridge, right? He's a person who has the kind of academic credentials, and he's the one who, of course, makes the great breakthrough that unifies all the knowledge that was known up to that point in the late 17th century. Okay, so for Whewell, Newton's a great example of what he would like scientists to be. People who are university-trained people, who are able to draw together different bodies of empirical knowledge and come up with underlying fundamental explanations for what they're about. Okay, so now, you know, all of this that I'm telling you now, we sort of take this for granted as to what science is about, but this actually had to be socially constructed, okay, in the sense that, you know, one thinks in terms of having to get special professional training to be able to do this, and it's not just something you can do in your garage on your spare time. Okay? And Whewell's the first one to really kind of launch this idea, the profession of the scientist, for which he believed that people should get salaries. Okay, again, that's an interesting point, right? You know, the whole idea of getting a salary for doing science, right, presupposes that you're doing it even when you're not coming up with anything interesting. But before this time, before the 19th century, right, science was kind of a hobby in a way, a kind of glorified hobby, right, the people who had leisure time typically pursued. Now, they may or may not have gone to university, but that was kind of an irrelevant consideration. Okay, so if you look at something like the establishment of the Royal Society, which is already in existence for 150 years by the time Whewell hits the scene, the Royal Society is basically a gentleman's club. Some of these people had university education, some of them didn't, and that didn't matter. What mattered was the way in which they transacted their business, right? The way in which they spoke about knowledge, the way in which they made claims to each other in terms of how they reasoned and showed evidence and all that kind of stuff. But whether one was professionally trained and whether one was kind of pursuing this as a lifelong pursuit to get at the truth of everything, that wasn't really necessary. You could be a member of the Royal Society and be a hobbyist. And in fact, that was true very much, you know, into the late 19th century as well. And in a sense, Charles Darwin might be thought of this way. Charles Darwin was university trained. He went to Cambridge. He did some work, actually. You know, he did some courses with Whewell, for example. But, you know, he was not an academic. He was independently wealthy. And he was very characteristic of the sort of person who was, you know, who had the time and the leisure, especially when it comes to the kind of work that Darwin himself was doing, which was largely, you know, this kind of naturalistic work. That is to say, you know, going around, spending a lot of time looking at things very closely, observing them carefully, having time to reflect and describe them. You know, I mean, that kind of, you need a lot of leisure. There's no job at the time that's paying you to do this. Right? I think this is very important. And see, one of the things that Whewell tries to do in the 1830s is to professionalize this and say, well, actually, we should make this a job. So Whewell's a very important kind of person. Now, the interesting thing about Whewell as well, and this is where he kind of brings the question of what it is to do science into the kind of controversial terrain of theology and religion, is, as I've mentioned, Whewell was a natural theologian. In fact, he was, because he was a professor, right, he was, in fact, an ordained minister, which was necessary back in those days. And he wrote books on theology. And he didn't see really any big difference between writing about natural theology and writing about natural science. In fact, natural theology becomes the kind of covering explanatory theory for natural science. Right? And in a sense, he was very keen that if they're going to be professional scientists, they have to kind of be like that too. Okay? Now, what makes science possible? What makes the whole idea of pursuing science as a kind of lifelong career possible, rather than just a hobby because you're sort of curious about certain aspects of nature? But the whole idea of pursuing science as an end in itself, okay, what kinds of conditions does that presuppose? This is the kind of thing that Huell thought very deeply about in coming up with this idea of the scientist as a profession. Now, I'm talking so much about Huell because if you look at Charles Darwin's epigram in Origin of Species, it is, quote, from Huell about the nature of science. Okay, so Darwin has got Huell in the back of his mind as sort of the person who, in a way, defines what the scientific enterprise is about. And that is, and that is a fair thing to say. So, the first point that Huell raises, and this is, in a way, the point that kind of he's most closely associated with now, is the idea that nature is intelligible. Okay? Now, intelligibility, at one level, seems like a pretty harmless idea, you know, in the sense of, okay, it means that it's understandable, that we can make sense of things, we can see patterns or something. That's intelligible. Well, no, actually, Huell meant something a bit deeper, and it goes to the use, why he uses that particular word, intelligible, and it has to do with intellect, okay? And in the history of philosophy, the idea of the intellect, the human intellect, is a distinct kind of faculty, something different from sensation, different from perception, different from all the other psychological faculties we have. There's a strong tradition, which Huell is part of, that believes that this is the point, as it were, that overlaps with the divine mind. The aspect, you know, and again, you've got to think of this, he's a theologian, in a biblical context, human beings are created in the image and likeness of God. Well, where does that likeness and image of, you know, image and likeness stuff come in? You know, what as it were, is that about? It's not at the level of the material nature, obviously, because God is not a material being, at least not essentially. But it's going to have something to do with the thinking process. There are certain kinds of ideas, certain kinds of thoughts that human beings can have, and only human beings can have, by virtue of having been created in the image and likeness of God. And those are the things that actually enable us to believe that we can understand all of nature. Now, this is kind of an interesting point at many different levels, because one of the things that it motivates very strongly is the idea of science as a project that you just, you know, that's not just a hobby, not just because you're curious, and also not just something that, as it were, people do in their own lifetime but doesn't have any sort of follow-through in the subsequent lifetimes. Because, I mean, what Huell is imagining here, and this is, in fact, how we do think about science, right? We take this for granted, but it's not a trivial assumption, namely that science is an intergenerational project. Right? I mean, so certain people establish certain kinds of things in their lifetimes, which people accept, and then other people carry it forward, perhaps refuting it, changing it, and we kind of imagine this as some kind of trajectory that goes on and on and on. That's interesting. That's not trivial. And that's not something that you can find in every culture. Of course, every culture is interested in how nature works, and there's a lot of curiosity, and people come up with very sophisticated theories and technologies and so forth. Right? I mean, that yes, it's everywhere. But the whole idea that there is a common project that in a way is very intimately tied to who we are as human beings, called science. Because, you know, once Huell establishes this kind of role of the scientist, right? I mean, once it takes off, right, it gets seen as a very prestigious thing, right? This is like what this is like the pinnacle of human achievement. And he manages to make Newton kind of the most significant human being who ever lived, you know, give or take Jesus Christ, depending on what religion you are. Okay? I mean, and he's the one who establishes that. And so science becomes this kind of signature, you know, of what human beings are about, that what makes us distinctive. Okay? And it's an intergenerational project that goes on and on and on. And you might say, well, why? Why do we think that there is something, as it were, that we, some ultimate mystery that we're trying to penetrate here? You know, when Newton says, I have seen as far as I have because I stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, why is that compelling? You know, why is that compelling? Why don't we say, as we do with lots of activities, well, you know, in one lifetime, you've come up with this theory, and that's kind of nice. And then next generation, they come up with their theory, and that's kind of nice. And then the generation after that, they come up with their kind of theory, and that's kind of nice. And you don't see it as somehow cumulative or going somewhere to some kind of ultimate truth or reality. But science is like that. Okay, and it's quite clear if you look at where Huell's coming from on this, he's modeling this on some kind of salvation story. That this is basically a secular version of the theological salvation story where, you know, humanity eventually is going to come back to the kingdom of heaven. And it's going to be able to see God. Only it's a very intellectualized version of it. Okay. Now, what are the characteristics of this sort of intelligibility that he's aiming for? Well, I think it's a kind of intelligibility that you actually see still today in physics. And first of all, it's the idea that reality is unified. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means it's not just enough to understand empirical reality in its own terms. So, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, I can understand how this particular animal works, and I can understand how this other particular animal works, and I can perhaps control and predict its behavior in the relevant environments in which it normally operates. That's fine. But why do I think that in some sense there's a general theory of animals? And more importantly, why do I think that that general theory of animals somehow has to be, you know, compatible, if not deducible, from some larger theory of matter and motion? Right? This is the whole idea of unification, right? That science is about unifying branches of knowledge. So that we find it problematic, for example, if it looks like some sciences operate with assumptions that are incompatible with the assumptions of other sciences. We find that a problem. We don't just say, oh, science, each science can have its own assumptions, whatever they want. No, there's a problem because we assume there is a one conception of reality, and that ultimately that oneness will come by unifying all of these different forms of knowledge that we get from it. Okay. Now, in Huell's day, it was quite common to sort of use this Latin term, vera causa, which Darwin uses as well. Okay, the true cause, like the underlying cause, right? The thing that really moves all, you know, so nature is disparate. It moves in many different directions. It appears in many different ways. There's no doubt about it. If you're a pure empiricist, there's just diversity out there. Things are always changing. They're always different. But we can see unity. We can see patterns. Not, you know, we can see patterns in the first instance, but we can see more than patterns. We can kind of see deep patterns, and these deep patterns actually allow us to control the phenomena. Right? And again, we go back. Think about physics, what physics has been about. Okay? I'm trying to unify all the fundamental forces of nature and so forth, which at the level of the empirical look very different from each other. But nevertheless, we all, you know, the physicists say it's really just, you know, a finite set of laws or principles that explain all this widely variant stuff. That's the idea of the vera causa, which is what they called it at that time. So this is a unifying principle. And then the other issue is that reality is deep. And that's already implied in what I've been talking about. Namely, that you always have to go beyond the phenomena. That just understanding the phenomena on the surface, even surface patterns, is not enough. That there are underlying causes that in a way will show the relationship between things that on the surface don't look very similar to each other. Okay, so there's a sense in which reality is deep. And that, in fact, is one of the things that warrants why science can't just be done in one lifetime. That it's something that takes a long time to do and many people need to be involved in it. Okay? So Huell is basically the one who kind of gets that kind of picture, which I think we very much take for granted today. And I think we take it, and I think it's a picture that we need to always kind of come back to, because that's really what I would say needs to be explained. We want to say, you know, why do we have science? This is the issue here. It's not an issue of why do we pursue knowledge. I mean, because it's easy to give a kind of straightforward, you know, evolutionary or behavioral answer to that question. Right, because obviously there's adaptive value to pursuing certain forms of knowledge. But the whole idea of pursuing this kind of unified ultimate form of knowledge over many generations, okay? The thing about that is, how does that fit into an evolutionary story? What is so adaptive about doing that? Now, I ask you that question because if you think about the sort of things that this kind of project has kind of thrown up over the last couple of hundred years, okay, first of all, we find that a lot of this pursuit ends up leading people to come up with very highly speculative and on the surface very bizarre theories, especially in mathematics and geometry and so forth, which nevertheless turn out to be true. So in other words, these mathematical speculations, if you want to talk about what's the evolutionary adaptive value of coming up with non-Euclidean geometry 50 or 100 years before Einstein, it's not at all obvious why people should be spending their time doing this kind of thing. It's just fantasy. That's what you would say, okay? But it turns out this stuff is true. And also, there's also all of, you know, if you look at the history of physics, right, as physics has come to a deeper and more unified understanding of the nature of reality, it has obviously given us greater and greater technological power, which of course, you know, perhaps exemplified the most by nuclear energy. Now, nuclear energy is a double-edged sword. Has nuclear energy increased our adaptive advantage? It's not obvious, okay? I would like to maintain to you, by ordinary Darwinian criteria, it is not at all obvious that having nuclear energy, you know, if you had to make the, if you were in a position, you know, if you were like the Darwin God, and you had to make a decision as to, should human beings pursue nuclear energy, given all the things that can come from that versus not, it's not obvious that you would say, yeah, pursue nuclear energy, given the possibilities for annihilation that come from it. Right? Because at the end of the day, the Darwinian evolutionary game is about survival, right? Survival is the ultimate value. And the forms of knowledge that are most easily explained from a Darwinian standpoint are those that can prove their evolutionary adaptiveness. And that is to say, increase the likelihood that the particular species is going to be able to reproduce itself successfully in the environment. Which is to say, not to increase the level of risk that that species will have to sustain. Now, we are in a very interesting situation in this world today, aren't we? Because we are in the most advanced scientific period in our history, no doubt about it, but we are also in an incredibly risky period. Now, what would Darwin make of that? How does that look from an evolutionarily adaptive standpoint? One would have thought that if you really want to say, well, look, we need the kind of knowledge that actually enables us to adapt to our environment successfully, we should be scaling down our ambitions. We shouldn't be pursuing this nuclear stuff. We shouldn't be doing all of this large-scale, crazy stuff that presupposes we're masters of the universe. Right? Because the whole, you know, part of the agenda of the nuclear thing isn't just the technological side, but there's also this kind of intellectual project, right, about understanding the fundamental forces of nature that apply not only on Earth where we live, but everywhere. Right? That's the big justification for the particle accelerators and stuff like that. If it were just about Earth, it wouldn't need be nearly so persuasive. But it's about the universe. Okay? I stress this because, again, from a Darwinian standpoint, how do you explain this? Okay? How do you explain this? I actually don't think you can explain it very well, to be perfectly honest. And one of the interesting things about this is that if you actually go back to Darwin's time, and Darwin's own attitudes towards science, right, you actually find, and I think this is very easy, I think it's not a very controversial point to maintain, that Darwin had very low expectations for what science could do with regard to improving the human condition. Okay, I think that's a very important point. And I'm going to give you some examples of this. And this has a lot to do with the sense in which, over the course of writing Origin of Species, right, which in a way starts off with this great Hewlian vision of coming up with a sort of unified understanding of the nature of life, right, where he actually thought in the beginning that he was going to vindicate the existence of some sort of intelligent designer, but then he ended up with natural selection, okay, that in a sense, his project demystified his views about what science could do. So that Darwin ends up actually having fairly diminished expectations with regard to what science can do, especially with regard to asserting the primacy of human beings. There's some very interesting kinds of examples of this that come out, especially after Darwin becomes famous. One of them has to do with this issue, which you're probably familiar with, which gets associated with Darwin a lot, and that's eugenics. And of course, it is true that, well, first of all, the first point, you may already know this, that Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, right, was the originator of eugenics, certainly coined the word. And Galton certainly thought what he was doing was taking Darwin's theory and, as it were, turning natural selection into a principle that could be used to enhance artificial selection, as understood normally in sort of animal husbandry and so forth, only now applied to human beings. Okay, and that's normally how we think about eugenics. And I think it's always worth pointing out in a context like this that Galton was a man of the left. Right, and that the people in this country, so Galton is writing in the final quarter of the 19th century, that the people who really thought that his ideas had strong political potential in this country were the Fabian socialists. Okay, and I think here, I mean, those of you who have some familiarity, of course you know about the London School of Economics, which was founded by the Fabians, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, in 1895. If you look at the history of that institution, which is normally seen as the flagship social science institution in this country, right? One of the previous directors, Lord Dahrendorf, wrote a history of the LSC back in 1995, so the 100th anniversary. And one of the things you find is that even though the London School of Economics has never had a department of biology because it's a social science place, right? Nevertheless, this whole idea that social policy and social welfare considerations have to be underwritten by some kind of biological understanding of humanity, with the idea of improving, okay? Eugenics, of course, gets taken out once it becomes a kind of bad word to use, but nevertheless, the sensibility is still there, very much. And in fact, the man who created the welfare state in this country, Lord Beveridge, who was another director of the LSC just at the end of World War II, he said that the foundational discipline of the social sciences on which the welfare state is based is called social biology, and he actually tried to recruit professors in this area. Okay, so I mean, I do think, and if you think about how the welfare state operates, and by the way, I'm saying this, I'm trying to present this in a pretty neutral way, and in fact, I'm quite sympathetic with a lot of this. I'm a person of the left myself, but I do think this is worth always keeping in mind where all this stuff is coming from, right? The idea of vital statistics, life expectancies, using these kind of biological indicators as measures of social well-being, which again we take for granted very much today, but that's one of the legacies of eugenics. Okay, to actually think that you need a biological indicator, a health indicator, to figure out issues of welfare, right? Because back before eugenics, people were much more concerned about issues like happiness, understood as people's state of mind. And that idea has gotten a revival recently, as you know. Now we're concerned about what makes people happy, okay? But when eugenics got on the scene, this became a matter of trying to figure out the fundamental underlying biological preconditions that would enable happiness and everything else that contributes to welfare in society, okay? So Galton's legacy is not just a legacy about Nazis and Soviets and all the rest of it. It's also a legacy about the welfare state, not only in this country, but in Germany and Scandinavia as well, which of course predate the welfare state of this country. Okay, and Galton had this kind of influence. Now the interesting thing is about what's Darwin's attitude toward this, because Galton basically is always trying to recruit Darwin for this. There's lots of correspondence, they're relatives, right? And Galton wants Darwin to make a few noises that will help him, get some kind of publicity, basically, as we would say today. Darwin refuses. Because Darwin doesn't believe our knowledge will ever be good enough to be able to make these kinds of decisions at a positive level. That at most what we can do is perhaps weed out, the mentally deficient or whatever and prevent them from reproducing. And so he wasn't against that part of it. But he didn't believe in the positive aspect of eugenics was that in some sense you could actually breed better people. He never thought our science would be good enough for that because he thought something quite fundamentally mysterious and uncontrollable about the way in which genetics worked. And if you know about Darwin's views about genetics, they were all over the place. He had a little bit of just about every view that was on the market at the time. Okay. And so, but to his credit, he was very cautious about what could be done with that. And Galton thought, no, we got a science of genetics that's just on the other side of the rainbow here, and once we get that science down, we'll be able to really legislate on these matters. Okay, and so Darwin's quite conservative and quite cautious. He doesn't believe that science will ever reach that kind of point. So he believes there's a limit to what science can do. Okay. Another example comes dealing with his friend and his great defender, Thomas Henry Huxley. Okay. Now, Thomas Henry Huxley is one of the people in this country who is very much responsible for bringing in vivisection in medical teaching. Okay, so Thomas Henry Huxley is a surgeon by training, very important in the establishment of Imperial College London, and was one of the great promoters of the idea that you need to cut up animals in order to do research that will be of benefit to humans. Now, this was a very controversial view. Yeah, but obviously it's very controversial today too, of course. But it was very controversial back then as well. And part of Huxley's thinking was twofold. One of them, in a way, retaining a kind of pre-Darwinian view that medicine is for the promotion of human beings. And, you know, if you've got to choose between animals and humans, humans come first, and so you can use animals for purposes of promoting the human condition through experimentation. As it were, the animals will be dying for a higher cause, you might say. Okay? So he's got that, but he's also got this very Darwinian view that animals, you know, there's a sense in which we, as animals, are fundamentally constituted the same kind of stuff as a lot of the other animals, and so, in fact, we can learn a lot by opening up animals, and this is, in fact, a more humane way of operating than opening up humans. Or waiting for them to die, which was kind of the normal way to go, right? You'd wait for a human being to die, open them up, and try to infer if you can sort of control for the disease what exactly it was that led them to have these conditions. But now you can take a healthy animal, open them up, and study them closely. So he wants Darwin's support for this. Darwin hems and haws all over the place. He eventually says yes to a certain extent. Okay, but he gives arguments in his correspondence that are very reminiscent of somebody like Peter Singer today. Okay, where in a sense Darwin is quite respectful of the sensibility of animals, suffering, pain, all that kind of stuff that somebody like Peter Singer would raise today. And in addition, Darwin says, right, how much knowledge do you think you can get, and how much would that actually improve medicine when it got right down to it? And again, Darwin is quite pessimistic. He is quite, you know, has scaled down expectations about what it is that we can learn from science to ameliorate the human condition. Okay. Now the final witness is the great John Stuart Mill. Now, John Stuart Mill was someone, as you know, he's a great defender of liberalism, liberty, free speech, all this kind of stuff. And one of the things that he was promoting, especially toward the end of his life, was the idea of free information about contraception. Okay? That one of the ways that you can prevent, you know, that you should, that people should have as much information as possible about, you know, as much choice as possible, you might say, with regard to how they plan their futures, young people. And they need information about this. And that includes information about contraception. And Mill wanted Darwin to support this campaign. He went to Darwin and said, look, your name would matter a lot. Darwin said he didn't think it would make a difference. In fact, he thought this might actually confuse people. Okay? And that there's a sense in which, again, he makes the argument, as he makes before, namely that it is very difficult to do this kind of social planning exercise where, you know, you somehow think that you give people a lot of knowledge, they'll reason with it in the appropriate way, and you'll get the kinds of outcomes you're looking for. Darwin's very skeptical about this. And Darwin basically believed that there were instincts that people had that would, in a way, override whatever information was being provided. Okay? So again, you know, the capacity of human beings to be able to sort of bootstrap themselves up from their animal condition to some sort of higher, more intellectualized, more scientific condition, Darwin believed was quite minimal. Okay, in fact, one of the things that he really worried about increasingly as his life went on, because, you know, as you know, Darwin lives to 1882. So he is living up to the period where imperialism is beginning to, you know, is really hitting full force. And he really dislikes the idea that one of the characteristics of human beings, and he points this out in The Descent of Man, is that we are really, more than any of the other animals, we are given to fixed ideas. That is, you know, and what he means by fixed ideas are kind of like abstract notions that people will just die for. And he claims he sees this already in the savages of Tierra del Fuego and things like where, you know, and he initially associates this with religion, but he thinks this actually carries through with nationalism, and he thinks that certain kinds of scientific ideologies fuel this attitude. Because imperialism was about a lot of things at once, right? I mean, it was obviously a kind of a Western movement, but it had a lot of different components, a large part of which was scientific, the spread of science coming through imperialism. Okay? And he thought that this was, in fact, quite damaging. Okay? Now, I'm raising all this kind of stuff because I think Darwin, once he reached the conclusion, right, that the nature of life is determined by natural selection, so there's a sense in which there is no purpose, there is no larger purpose, there is just a kind of mechanism by which variations are generated, and then there is the world, that the environment, which then decides which ones live and die, and that's just, and it just keeps on happening. And the one thing you can be sure of is that any species, you know, that has been alive in the past will die eventually, and new ones will replace them. Okay? That given that that's the picture he comes up with, he actually ends up having a very sort of diminished sense of what it is that human beings can expect to accomplish in the great scheme of things. Are we not just another one of the instances of his own theory? A creature who is on the earth for a certain amount of time, who has a certain amount of control over the environments in which it normally inhabits, but then when it goes outside of that, as it were, evolutionary comfort zone, disaster waits. Okay? And I think, you know, if you look at a lot of the rhetoric that's surrounding a lot of the climate change discussion that's going on now, right, I think you can see the hand of Darwin there very much. I think Darwin would definitely be on the side of the people who believe that, you know, we're going to extinguish ourselves if we don't cut back very soon. I would put Darwin in that category. Okay? And that, of course, the people who oppose this view are the people who believe that there, you know, let's take put aside the people who deny that there is any kind of climate change going on. I'll put those people aside. But there are the people who do admit there's climate change going on, but say, not to worry. We'll get over this. We'll have a technological fix of some sort. We'll seed the clouds or do something, right? We'll do something amazing because we're human beings. You know, and as it were, necessity is the mother of invention, and we're special, and we can do it, and we can conquer it. Okay? Now, that is, I think, very indicative of the way in which science has historically played itself out in our culture in making human beings feel that they are the top of nature. Okay? The technological fix. Yes, nature is throwing obstacles to us, but unlike other creatures, who in the end will be extinguished by nature, we will overcome nature. We will replace nature. Okay? And if you look at the history of political economy, you know, Ricardo, Marx, all these people, that's what the language is about, right? We're going to remake nature. We're going to remake the world. And, you know, and this, I would submit to you, is a secular holdover from an old kind of theological vision, right, that human beings have been put on earth to create a heaven on earth. And in a sense, God's got the job half done, you might say, and now it's up to human beings to finish it off. Okay, and that nature is the enemy. Nature is the thing that resists God's will, and we're going to fix it. Darwin doesn't buy any of this, right? Darwin, the scales fall from Darwin's eyes. He doesn't buy this kind of picture. He believes nature wins in the end. We're just a part of nature. We're only part of a small part of the entire history of nature. And as a result, he ends up having a fairly diminished view of what science can do. Okay? And so it seems to me that this raises a kind of interesting question. So, for you know, and I'll, since we're getting to the time when I want to open it up to some questions, if you were to bring Darwin back today and put him, let's say, on some sort of science board to decide on projects and things like this, I think he would be the first guy to want to cut the big stuff, the stuff that claims to be doing, you know, large-scale things that will transform the planet and stuff like that. Anything that will actually increase the level of risk that the planet has to undergo. This, I think, would be Darwin's default view on the matter. And that, in a sense, he would be one of the people who thinks that that science ought to be more self-critical. And, in fact, ought to be more like the kinds of knowledge that, in fact, animals, many of whom have been on the planet for a lot longer than we have, right, have cultivated for themselves. That is, a knowledge of the environments in which they normally operate, where they can survive and reproduce successfully, and not go beyond that. Okay? And I think that's kind of the challenge, in a way, for people who want to consider themselves really dyed-in-the-wool Darwinists and believe that Darwin is right. And he, you know, ultimately, you can give a Darwinian explanation for everything. Okay? Especially everything concerning human beings. The question is going to be, how do you explain the fact that the history of science has proceeded as it has up to this point? Because it hasn't been the way that one would expect or would, as it were, desire from a Darwinian standpoint. And Thomas Henry Huxley actually realized this point toward the end of his life. And I'll close with this. He gave a very famous lecture in 1893 called the Romanes Lecture on Evolution and Ethics. And he said that the big, so this is 1893, at the dawn of the 20th century. He's saying that the problem that's going to face the 20th century, given that Darwin has proved his case as far as he was concerned, was how are you going to continue to motivate the ambitious science of the kind of Newton that basically aspires to understand everything about the universe? How are you going to continue to motivate that, given that now Darwin has given us this very self-demystifying understanding of the kind of creature we are? We are no longer the creature created in the image and likeness of God, which is what Newton thought and what Whewell thought, but rather we are just one of among many animal species who exist for a certain limited period of time. Now, once that sinks in, as it were, as you know, your self-understanding of who you are in the world, how do you then motivate people to do the grand projects of science? And I think that question, which Huxley was posing in 1893, I think, you know, in a way needs to be reposed today, even in a stronger fashion, okay? With that, I'll stop and open it up for discussion. So thank you very much for listening. Sure. The Freeman Dyson argument. Well, I mean, it's a very strange. I mean, in a sense, it's a kind of. I would put that kind of way of thinking about things, this sort of Freeman Dyson idea that we can seed the universe with ourselves. I would put that in the category of the technological fix. I don't think that's a very Darwinian way of thinking about this. Right, because what it does is it just sort of it treats every kind of obstacle as just another challenge to overcome. I mean, I personally am sympathetic with the technological fix argument, truth be told, and I think it is a real serious problem for Darwinism that it ends up leaving us with a very diminished understanding of science, at least of what science can accomplish. I think, I don't think Darwin would go for this. Go off into the heavens. I think Darwin understood the theory of evolution very much as an earthbound thing, about earthbound creatures. I realize nowadays people talk about having Darwinian views about how galaxies come into being and stuff like that, but that's way off of what Darwin was talking about. I mean, in fact, Darwin is quite specific about our being earthbound creatures. Okay, I think you're when you start bringing that stuff up, you're really talking about a different ballgame. One with which I have some sympathy, but I don't think it's Darwin's fault. I think Darwin would be very skeptical of this. Again, you know, like I said in the end, if Darwin were in the science board, he'd kill all those Freeman Dyson projects.
And when you're looking at the various people who have tried to enlist Darwin into their various scientific causes and so on and so forth, you seem to be evolving from that an idea of what Darwin's thoughts about science actually work.
Yeah.
Strikes me, though, that it's got more to do with personality than actually his views about science. And he's notoriously reclusive, doesn't want to come out and get involved, even with putting forward his own theories in many cases. He's not very healthy, he's also quite diffident and polite. I suspect, though, that what you're saying, you're putting forward is his views on these various aspects of science, whether he gets involved, what he thinks about them, might be just down to him politely brushing off people by saying, well, I don't know, not really, I don't think this is it, just so that he can stay at home.
One of the interesting things about Darwin, and I'm sure someone who's spoken in this series has already remarked, is the fact that there's such a fascination about his personality. You know, in a way, his personality does play a role in people's understanding of what his theories are about and what their significance is and so forth, in a way that's quite uncommon with other scientists. And I take your point. I mean, so for example, you know, this whole preoccupation that Darwin has about extinction and that we're not going to be around forever and we should just get used to it, it isn't just based on the fossil record or whatever, right? It's also based on the death of his children, right? I mean, it's so there's these personal things. No, but the point is that one can always give a kind of, there's always a personal analog to a lot of these more theoretical points. But in terms of the evidence for the kinds of things I'm saying, Darwin actually has, you know, a lot of sustained correspondence with these guys where he's kind of going, you know, in a private space, admittedly, but he's going back and forth on these issues, right? So with Huxley in particular, a lot of exchange of letters, and Darwin does occasionally write to newspapers, you know, letters to the editor of the Times, this kind of stuff, on the vivisection stuff. So you do get a sense of, you know, you're right, he's not a public speaker. You know, he doesn't like to leave his house. All that is true. But there, you know, there is a kind of paper trail based on his correspondence that I think captures that there's also an intellectual side to this, that there is a sort of genuine kind of reluctance and a kind of sense of, I don't think this actually will deliver the goods you think it will. I mean, so, you know, Darwin, I think Darwin would be someone who would be very much in favor of the precautionary principle in environmental issues, if you're familiar with that. There's this, I don't know how familiar people are with environmental politics, but there's this thing called the precautionary principle that gets adopted by a lot of intergovernmental agencies as a kind of standard that one should use in judging whether one engages in certain kinds of industrial activities and so forth that could potentially change the environment. You know, you take, as it were, the potential risk very seriously. And if the potential risk is high, even if the benefits would be high, you don't do it. That's the precautionary principle. So, as it were, you're basically preventing worst outcomes rather than promoting best ones. And I think Darwin would fit with that view.
I think it's difficult to extrapolate from the social context, his personal context.
Yeah, but see, he had a lot of opportunities. The thing is, he was asked a lot. He does respond. He doesn't ignore the queries. He does respond in detail. He has measured, thought-out views. I mean, and there are views, and they are views that he holds, that you can see them today. It's not like Darwin has very idiosyncratic views that we could not recognize and we have to somehow attribute to his, you know, his mental state or something. Actually, a lot of his views are held by people today. So the people who don't want, you know, animals being tested in labs, the arguments they use are not a million miles from his reservations. Okay? And so I don't think that's unreasonable. And the interesting thing is, there is a pattern. It's not just on one issue. Okay, it's on all sorts of issues. Where in a sense science is in a public position to assert its significance in leading society, and Darwin begs off. So I do think, I mean, yes, there's the personal issue, but I do think there's an intellectual side to this that shouldn't be ignored.
I think that he's doing this on the basis that he doesn't want to be a figurehead. And he's got to communicate to anybody, you know, any views that might suggest.
No, I understand that. I'm sure. I'm sure that's part of it, but one thing that is very interesting about Darwin and is that Darwin is a very he's a very scrupulous correspondent. In other words, he really does try, as it were, to answer what his interlocutor is asking, and you know, so he doesn't fob people off, right? Darwin gives considered responses to everything. And so I think that, you know, so we can learn from that, it seems to me, in terms of what his state of mind was. He doesn't just say, oh, you know, he's not like a movie star or something who, you know, who thinks that Galton is part of the paparazzi, you know. He doesn't deal with it that way.
Now, this is why I think, you know, he gives a considered response, because he's very polite and diffident, and I think we know.
He might also have thought about it. But he also might have given some considered thought. I mean, I think that is where... Sorry.
Yes. I'm sure if we ask him sure. The science and books later on, he would mind sticking around. So, is there another question there? Thank you.
There's a recent biography about Desmond Moore.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah.
The main theme in that is
James Moore and Adrian Desmond, yeah.
The main theme in that is that Darwin had thoughts, and it was basically the unity of humanity
yeah.
And the unity of nature.
Yes.
When it comes to things like God and eugenics, uh-huh. Yeah, he was in Edinburgh when it was heavily studied at Newcastle University there, but he sort of shied away from it quite publicly, I think. He quite said no, that the racial distinctions yep. weren't there. And certainly by taking an active part in the atmosphere throughout his life.
Yeah, I mean, but remember, okay, this biography is quite an interesting biography. But I think the key thing to mention about it is it really is concerned with Darwin's early years. Right? Because remember, there isn't really, certainly in this country, there's not really an anti-slavery movement to speak of after about, what, 1820, 1830, because it's dealt with.
No, it's still...
Not in the 1860s and 70s there isn't an anti-slavery movement to deal with in this country.
They still wanted to ban slavery. What they banned in the 1830s.
Okay, but the point is that Darwin's views actually on the unity of humanity change over the course of his life. And Desmond and Moore focus on the early days, where Darwin is actually most under the influence of his parents and his relatives, who are Unitarians and Quakers and people like that, from whom you get this kind of, this idea of a unified, universalist conception of humanity, regardless of race, color, creed, etc. But as Darwin does more and more, and of course Darwin is very much impressed personally by the experiences of the slaves being mistreated when he's traveling in the Beagle, right, in Latin America and all that. That's of course very important, very well documented, but he's a very young man back then, okay? When you start moving into the 1860s and 70s, and this is when eugenics and stuff like that kicks in, Darwin actually changes his view. He doesn't become a eugenicist. No, never becomes a eugenicist. But he does think that there are differences in mental capacities between races and so forth. And he actually gives his universalism, this thing that Moore and Desmond are promoting in the book, actually becomes very muted in a book like The Descent of Man. Okay? And that in fact there are people who follow Darwin from that book, and he doesn't stop them, actually doing a kind of ranking of the races of humanity. Okay? And you see, I think one thing that is very tricky in talking about this kind of matter, about the status of race and the unity of humanity in the 19th century, is that the people who were most quickly up front in being anti-racist and being for the unity of humanity typically did it on principled theoretical grounds. Yeah. Right? And the problem was that when people started studying the different living conditions of all the different types of people, empirical arguments started to be made for racism. Right, and I'm not talking just about Darwin, but basically the early history of anthropology, right, which comes in the wake of Darwin, right, ends up saying, well, wait a minute, maybe it's just some kind of religious sentimentality about the image and likeness of God that leads you guys to think that these human beings, so-called human beings who live in these radically different conditions, are actually part of the same species, right, because they actually see just how different the lives are and how difficult it is to actually have them live somewhere else. That's right. Yeah, so, you know, this is a very tricky kind of issue. And I think what Desmond and Moore are doing in their book is basically You know, I think it's important to sort of show that Darwin, at least in the beginning, when he was thinking about stuff, had this very clear, unified view about humanity, and he was clearly an anti-slavery person. That you can't take away from him. He was anti-slavery, no doubt about it. But I think, in a sense, the anti-slavery issue, as the century wears on, is not really that salient an issue for the racism issue. Because racism gets based on different things.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
So what should we care about what Darwin would think today? Isn't there kind of a problem that people kind of might treat Darwin as someone like Marx or Protestant, or even find the solutions of his theory in his books, because kind of created something, a method that since then can explore or something else?
Hey, you're preaching to the choir, guy, but look, we're in Darwin year. Why am I here? Right, if people, you know, if the person Darwin didn't matter in some way, in some sense his spirit continues to legitimate all this stuff that goes on under the name of evolutionary biology, if that weren't happening, we wouldn't be having these kinds of events, frankly. And it is, from a sociological standpoint, you're asking a very smart question, right? Like, why does Darwin confer all this significance in a way in which the lives of other scientists don't? I mean, not even Newton. I mean, Newton... you know, if you look at the anniversaries associated with Newton, like let's say the 300th anniversary of Principia Mathematica, you know, perhaps the greatest book ever written in science, right, was in 1987. Now, I'm sure a lot of you weren't alive in 1987. Do you recall Newton hoopla to the extent that we're getting this Darwin hoopla? I don't think so. That's interesting, isn't it? That's interesting, right? And you raise a very valid point. No, but I do think that in this environment, not just at the popular level, but even somewhat at the scientific level, you can make important claims by making claims about what Darwin would say. And that's a sociological fact about the times in which we live. But you're right, there is an issue, a kind of deep issue. Why is that? Okay? And I think, you know, what it probably has to do with is the fact that much more clearly than Newton, Darwin's work really impinges on what it is to be a human being. You know, so in other words, you know, even though Darwin, you know, made a very clear point of trying to separate out what he was talking about so he didn't make it look like everything just automatically applied to human beings and what he was saying, nevertheless, the area in which he worked really quite naturally lends itself to a kind of self-reflection of who we are as beings. And I think that's where you start to get the rub up against theology and religion, which is another subject that tries to tell us who we are as well. And I think that's a very important part of the equation here. But you're right. You're right to wonder, why is it that Darwin's opinions matter so much, you know, so many years after the book was published, and so much, you know, and that the research that's conducted today bears very little resemblance to the research he himself was engaged in, etc., etc.
Thank you very much for all your questions, and thank you again, Professor Fuller.
Thank you, everybody.
If you haven't had a chance to look at one of our science room leaflets, there's loads in the front. And then we also have some happy birthday Darwin leaflets. And just a reminder, everyone, that next week on Tuesday, the 6th of October, we have Professor Carlos Frank coming to do a lecture for us.